Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You're listening to Total EM. Today, we are actually going over what some may consider more of a soft skill, the thing that doesn't always get taught, at least in the classroom. But I know for PA schools, we do cover it a lot. But at least with our experience, I think Adrian will say the same thing. We don't see everyone do this very well. And some people do it excellent. I like to think that I'm probably doing it fairly well because unfortunately in the emergency department, just like in primary care and stuff like that, we break bad news all the time. But there are good ways to break bad news and there's not so good ways to break bad news. And joining me today is Adrian Banning. And she is an awesome PA who works in academia more. And her love is with evidence-based medicine, and she actually also is on a podcast with Chris Madej for JAPA, but I don't want to steal any more of Adrian's thunder. Adrian, can you tell us a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Adrian Banning. I'm a full-time faculty member at a large PA program in Philadelphia. We do teach this in a course called Patient Communication, kind of delivering bad news. How are we interacting with patients? And so EBM, definitely probably my first love, but you doesn't matter what you know about evidence-based medicine. It's all about how you communicate it. So those things go perfectly together. And this kind of came up because we were interacting on Twitter, right? And you had expressed that you had a difficult conversation that you were surprised no one else had had. And I said, you definitely need to cover this because I think it's something that so many people struggle with, that wish they knew more about.
Yeah, it's kind of a long story, and it's one that we're probably going to have almost as a separate podcast of itself, talking about when you get in these really intense situations. But breaking bad news overall is something that's so difficult to do, especially in the emergency department. Sometimes we're going to be the first ones to deliver that bad news simply because it's so acute. But what about those ones that are chronic? And that was the issue that I had with that specific scenario that I gave on Twitter. And unfortunately, with that, I've been dealing with this for a while, and I think about these cases quite a bit. And really, Adrian, you're the one who finally said I need to get something out there, because it's one of those things. It's how do you do it, and how do you do it well, and how do you talk about the evidence? Well, you, mm-hmm. the EBM guru here, actually went ahead and kind of gave me that final push to say, let's go ahead and talk about this. So, you know, we'll talk a little bit about maybe some different examples that we have in previous experiences, because there's always a ton of them. I guess, first off, let's go over some of your stuff on this.
There is a pretty broad evidence base on this, but the caveat is that we're talking about evidence and something kind of we're trying to quantify about human emotion, and it kind of escapes that realm as well. So there's a lot about how do patients perceive our empathy when we're communicating? How are we trained to do it? How do providers feel that they're doing it well or not? So there's a lot out there, and I think you can listen to all of it or read all of it. But in the end, it really just comes down to two people communicating and how strong can evidence really be on that. But there's a lot more there. And I've included some references that I'm sure, Chip, you can post. So my experience is as a human, as a family member who's watched news get delivered, as a patient, as a PA, when I've done it well and when I've done it poorly. And I'm also the course director for our patient communication course here. So it kind of seems paradoxical that we're all healthcare providers. If you're a healthcare provider listening to this, you've chosen to go into a field where you can apply your skills to help people, but we aren't always great at showing empathy. Even if we think we're doing it great, it kind of doesn't matter. It's really about the patient's perception. And really, no matter what realm of medicine you're in, at some point, you're going to be part of someone's worst memory. The worst time in their life, you're in that scenario. So there's a lot of pressure to contribute in a way that's positive. There's so much pressure that I think sometimes we freeze up a little bit. And there's some evidence that kind of shows that sometimes we don't do what we'd want to do. We want better skills with this than is perceived. So you're going to be part of someone's worst case scenario at some point, and you have control really over how you're perceived in that scenario.
And keep in mind that the bad news or the worst day is not the same for everyone. especially sometimes you've been doing this for a while, you may start to get jaded and it's like, it's not that big of a deal for something.
Right.
But let's talk about some examples here real quick where you think about classically, you know, someone's dying or is about to die or just passed away, whatever the case may be. When that person's life ends or is about to end, that's a pretty obvious, hard, solid, breaking bad news moment, right? But what about right. the things about, this was one I literally saw not that long ago, was someone who is training as a ballerina, mm-hmm. and she has a major laceration to her knee. And I'm repairing it up, and we're talking about things in general. And I didn't know that she was a ballerina at first. And we're talking about how there's going to be some limitation activities. And then when I talked about where this is at, we probably need to rest this for a little bit. And she asked, well, do you think I can do some dancing next week? And I said, probably not. I don't think you're going to be able to go to the club kind of thing. And she said, no, I do ballet. And all of a sudden, when you realize that you're putting this together, for her, this is devastating, right?
Right.
This is something that's going to change her for at least a little while. It may not be a permanent issue. And
right.
I hope for her sake that it's not. But you talk about someone who literally has this big change in their lifestyle and something that is obviously very important for them. Yes, you may think, well, this is any other laceration, or you may think about the kid playing football who's about to go to college on a full ride scholarship, breaks their knee. That's a pretty big deal there too. So again, mm-hmm. keep in mind, you may not know the full text of the situation, and we need to keep in mind that for these individuals, what may not sound like the worst news to us may actually mm-hmm. be very vital to them. And we talk about that a little bit with some of the evidence here in a second, but this is the anecdotal stuff that I feel like this is one of the times anecdotes actually helps out. And I think you have some examples yourself.
Obviously, I'm not a huge fan of anecdotes, except, you know, we all have them. It's not the strongest form of evidence because everyone can kind of drill something up. But this is, you're exactly right, a great place where an anecdote is someone's experience of something in their story. And you were kind of alluding to breaking bad news is maybe just delivering the news that's going to change someone's identity. So you have a ballerina who now can't dance. Is she still a ballerina? How does that affect her identity? So, for example, I have a colleague that works with women after they've gone through breast cancer treatment. And maybe they've had a mastectomy and maybe they've had reconstruction, but that changes their identity. So to regain a sense of identity and who they are after that process, you might be delivering bad news in some way that doesn't impact their ability or something that you can see from the outside, but it changes how they perceive themselves. So that's something to be aware of. I just read an article, and I wish I would have pulled it for this, about someone who was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And we think, it's not the end of the world. You'll take your meds, you'll take your insulin, but now they can't travel and they can't just go out into the forest. They're always going to be tied to their insulin. And for them, that was a change in their identity. So that was an editorial, and I'll see if I can drill that up. But
yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah. What my friend who works with breast cancer patients talks about is after their whole experience, the anecdotes that he hears the most is what the patients remember is that moment when they got the diagnosis. These are people who've gone through diagnosis, treatment, chemo, rehab, surgeries. And what sticks out to them the most, what comes up the most in conversation, is the moment they heard the bad news and kind of the horror stories of just that whoever told them sometimes didn't even sit down. We got to sit down. And that they didn't always feel that the person delivering the news cared about them. So to be aware of your body language, if you're facing them, what's between you? Do you have that ever-present computer? Are your arms crossed? Face the patient, sit down, if that's all you take away from this conversation today. Yeah, most providers realize that it's a really important thing, but when surveyed, say that they wish they had better skills in it, that they don't feel very comfortable with it.
And I feel like that's a common issue with this, is because can you really ever say, well, yes, I'm an expert in breaking bad news? Hopefully in some ways you don't feel that way. But at the same time, that's why I said, I feel like for myself, for as many times as I get to talk about it, that, you know, I understand a lot of the key points, but there's never going to be that perfect delivery, just because, again, a lot of this is individual based. And I think when we were talking about this before we even got online, was mm-hmm. that different people actually have different things that they care about when they get the news. And there's no way to really predict that. You can talk to a certain degree, especially if this is an established patient, maybe this is someone you've seen before, especially if this is anyone in primary care, mm-hmm. you may know what their core values are. So you may be able to better deliver news catered to them, or you understand a patient's limitations and understanding. So you avoid using certain technical language or those types of things. You may be able to modify in that sense, but knowing what words are going to be best for them is almost impossible. You can get pretty good at it, but it's very difficult to have that perfect setting. And the body language thing, I'm so glad you bring that up. I agree. The most important thing, if you can take this away from today, is anytime you're really giving news, especially bad news, but anytime you're really giving news, I really try and sit down with them. And if for some reason you can't sit, try and get eye level with them.
Right.
And I think we're going to talk about this more here in a second, but when you sit, you're not sitting on the desk or table like I tend to do when I'm just doing stuff in general.
Leaning. But
yeah, leaning. What I do is I try and make myself directly eye level, and I'm kind of tall, so I will actually get as low in height as I can with them, or better yet, get below their height.
Right.
In what would people call a submissive posture. And again, when you're giving bad news, a submissive posture is actually a good time to do that.
You have authority whether you're sitting or standing because you're the healthcare provider in the room, right? So whether you're sitting, lying on the floor, you're still in some way the authority in the room. So being below eye level just helps kind of equalize that even a little bit. You talked about before, Chip, that it really doesn't matter how much you do it. You could work in hospice, palliative care. There's a nice Cochrane review from 2013 that says, it really doesn't matter how much you do it. Experience doesn't make you any better at it. What does make you better is formal training, going and saying, I want to get better at this, and I'm going to go through a training program. So if you're not great at it, or if you want to be better, you can improve that skill, and it's not just going to be through experience. So yeah, there are some key things that we can say and some key things that patients are looking for from the evidence that we have. Again, everyone's going to be different. The best way to know what someone wants is simply to ask them. If you know them as a person, that's great, but we don't always have that luxury. What you want to think about is, what does the patient want to know of what's going to make it go well and what's going to make it go poorly? So there was just recently in an Irish medical journal from this year, an article on what we can learn from parents who have had the devastation of a stillbirth. So in this article, the parents identified what was most important to them in that moment was how the healthcare provider communicated was the language that was used and the empathy, the emotion and sensitivity that was conveyed. And if the healthcare provider seemed to be getting off track or not speaking directly, the patients in that study remembered acutely all the moments. It's that thing about emotional recall, emotional memories stick with us more. And the patients in that study who had just experienced this horrible, horrible loss felt a sense of mistrust, especially if they thought information was being withheld. So maybe you weren't trying to withhold information, but you weren't being as transparent as you could be, or you're using kind of ambiguous language. So what they really wanted was open, sensitive, honest communication. Then there's a review article from 2009 that I came across that kind of mirrors that. It's about the setting that the patients were in, the way that the information was communicated, how much information was provided, and if it seemed like there was emotional support. So where were you? What were you saying? And did it seem like you cared, basically? But that review pointed out a little bit more about demographics, and they found that younger patients, female patients, and people who were more highly educated wanted more information and more detailed information, and they wanted emotional support. The review also found that Asian patients were shown to prefer that they had family members there with them more so than Westerners, and they didn't want to discuss life expectancy as much as Westerners did. But obviously, we cannot just generalize patients into broad swatches like that. But it highlights the importance of being culturally appropriate and knowing what your patient wants first. And that there is a 6-step protocol that addresses that, that we're going to talk about a little bit more.
Right. And before we get into the spikes protocol, because that's what we're alluding to, and that's what a lot of this I feel like is alluding to, a couple of things on that. If you do not really have strong cultural training, I guess we can put it, this is something that is actually relatively easy to learn in different ways. There are some really good resources out there. There have actually been a couple of books that I've read about death and dying. Actually, I took this as an undergraduate class where the class was literally called Death and Dying, which you would think would be a very depressing class, but when you have a hippie teach it, it's actually a lot of fun. And we talked about all these different world perspectives, and like you said, you can't generalize too much, but if you understand the idea of how, for example, a follower of Islam versus a Hindu versus Catholic or a Taoist, whatever the case may be, we will run into all these different cultures at different points, and understanding what they feel about each type of setting and what they mean for things. A classic one is for certain Native American cultures. They have a strong belief that any negative outcomes you mention, like for a procedure, if you go into the details of it, if you say that's going to happen, that that could happen, then it means that it will happen to them. So you actually are going to use less of that language. Which is always very tricky for informed consent and things like that. But if you have a brief discussion about that first, you can kind of get into the right environment for that. But specifically regarding this case, you mentioned, for example, family. And family, I feel like, is very common for any one of these settings. But the technical language is a tricky part. And one of the things that I tend to use and that we kind of alluded to a second ago is make sure that you already have a thought process in your head, and the spikes mnemonic can help with this, but make sure you have a thought process in your head about what information you're going to give them. And your information needs to be blunt. So for example, saying that Mr. Smith has gone away, well, then now the family's trying to figure out where they've gone to,
right,
versus saying, I'm sorry, Mr. Smith has died, is right, a very different tone there. And then when you're talking about testing, yes, you need to make sure that you are giving proper information, but not being too technical. And so usually we can say, for the example, the broken knee, I'm very sorry, but you have a tib fib fracture. It's a pretty bad one.
Mm-hmm.
And if you start with that, they may start asking more technical details. Like, for example, if it is something like imaging, you bring in a picture so you can show them what it looks like. That's right, a common method I use. But just little things like that. If you start with the basics, because a lot of patients, and I've noticed this too, especially with like diagnosis of cancer, HIV, things like that, in my experience, and then also with the training, because our PA school did a really good job with this, was talking about how people, once you tell them the bad news, a lot of people shut down. They don't hear anything else you tell them.
Right.
And so it's very important to give them that information quickly, but at the same time realize that most people are not going to be cognizant enough to hear all the technical information and may not want it right then. And so at that time, you're going to go back and usually offer them at the end to say, I know this is a lot. We can talk about this more later, or let's make sure we get you in the right follow-up. Who can talk about this in more detail and give you more options?
So, right. That's a great point that you need to kind of be aware. The patient's nodding and they might be responding, but you kind of see in their eyes that they're not really, really there with you, and not using ambiguous information or words that you're clear, maybe blunt, but not crass or coarse, to not use words like, well, there was a shadow on your CAT scan. If you know it's cancer, then say cancer. Saying tumor or carcinoma or malignancy, they're words that we all think of on a daily basis, but if you need to communicate to a patient that they have cancer, then you just need to say that, but with sensitivity.
Absolutely. All right. I think we've alluded to this enough, Adrienne. Let's go into the big part, the part
that everyone wants to hear about spikes.
Everyone wants to hear about spikes.
Yeah. So this is actually also known as Buckman's 6-step protocol, and spikes is a mnemonic because, of course, it's medicine. How would we get through this process without a mnemonic? So it stands for setting up perception, invitation, knowledge, and emotion, and then strategy. But I'll walk through them if it's okay with you in a little
Absolutely.
Bit more detail. I don't know about you, but I I don't really ever remember the mnemonics, but at least it kind of gives you a little map. Okay, so we have the first S in spikes is for setting up. What's the environment like? Where are you? Is it quiet enough? Do you have tissues? Sometimes tissues are controversial. My students are like, do I put the tissues out? Does that tell them that they're going to be crying? What do I do with the tissues?
I can only imagine, like, I'm just going to bring this box of tissues in the room right now.
Everything's fine. Yeah.
So can I give you a quick tip of mine that I've learned how to do this?
Yeah, I'd love that.
So I think we were also involved in this conversation, but we're talking about white coats, whether or not you can have them, stuff like that. At least in the United States, there's no strict protocol against white coats right now. So I still have a white coat. And I think you can still do this with proper scrub pockets. But mm-hmm. I carry 2 packets of individualized Kleenex.
Perfect.
Packages. And they're small. And they're small enough that they fit in the white coat, no big deal. And the reason why I carry 2 is because inevitably you'll lose one or one will be opened up or whatever the case may be. But I always carry them with me, literally with every encounter, as long as I have my white coat with me, which is pretty much every single time. Mm-hmm. Because you never know, again, what bad news is actually bad news for them or how someone will react. And so right. You just keep it in your pocket. I cannot tell you how many times patients have thanked me for just being able to hand them a package of tissues. And so this is something that's very easy for you to do. And inevitably, if you don't carry the tissues with you, it's kind of that law.
That's the time.
That's the time you're going to need it. And that's the time you're not going to be able to find tissues anywhere. So just always have a couple of packages of tissues in your pocket and you can deliver this news a lot more appropriately without having someone see a box of tissues getting set out and like, oh, by the way, I have some bad news now.
Here, you're going to cry. Yeah. I love that. If they're in your pocket, I don't feel like anyone's ever told me that. And bad news is definitely harder when you have a bunch of snot obstructing how you're speaking or that it's running down your face. It's not fun. So I love it. Just keep tissues with you and just take them out when you need to.
Absolutely.
Okay, so then the next is perception. And here's where we get into how we know what patients want to know is we just ask them. How we know what language they use to refer to themselves or they use to talk about their disease is we let them use the language and then we just use the language that they're using. So what is their perception? It's great to find out what they know. You might know the patient and know what they know or think you know what they know, but hearing them talk about it gives you, it's kind of like the teach back method. When you hear the patient explain it in their words, then you know their understanding of it. So I saw as I was doing the research for this, a great phrase to say, if you weren't the one to explain this, tell me what other healthcare providers or tell me what other doctors have told you about your illness or about the disease or about what you were coming back in for today. You might know from the chart or from notes what someone else said, but that may not be what they heard. So what's their perception and use the language that they're using.
And this is a good example. There are a couple different ways you can do this. One is that a lot of this perception you may get from the beginning of your encounter, let's say this is someone where they said, well, I've been having this cough and fever and night sweats for the past couple of months. And you ask, well, have you seen someone? Well, I went and saw my doctor once and they did a chest x-ray and they said mm-hmm. they saw a spot, but I don't know what that means. And so you're like, oh, this already sounds not so good.
Right.
And then you do your imaging, your testing, whatever the case is, and you come back and now you have a more definitive answer. One way is you have that information up front. Sometimes you're not going to have that information. Let's say it's a car accident instead where someone has died while you're trying to resuscitate them. Family may only on that visit, on that you coming in to break the bad news, you may just say, well, what do you know about the accident? And so those are two very different approaches because with the first one, with the spot on the x-ray, I can actually go to them and say, I know we talked to them about this a little bit, but can you tell me a little more about what you understand? And this is usually very brief. I feel like it's important to say that. This is something that they're probably not going to go into a lot of detail and you don't necessarily need to go into a lot of detail in a lot of cases because you don't want to drag out the inevitable part of the knowledge sharing, but you at least want to understand where they're coming from. And so this may mm-hmm. take usually about 30 to 60 seconds in my experience. You're going to get a quick recap and understand what's going on there and what they understand.
I just think that's setting the groundwork and some people are really going to appreciate that. I can tell you from my experience in getting bad news I want you to skip this. Just tell me. When someone opens up with, I have to talk to you or I have bad news, I'm like, spill it. Just, we'll talk, we'll sort the rest out later, but let me know what I'm dealing with. And then I kind of like personally to go backwards in it.
I think a lot of patients actually will do that depending on your delivery too sometimes, because if they know bad news is coming, they'll like do exactly that. And so sometimes it's hard to get that perception part. And some people are not interested in the perception part. You just have to keep that at least in mind. So I definitely agree there.
Yeah, don't force it. No, this is the part where we gain your perception, right?
I have to follow this mnemonic. It says I have to go to pee next.
Right. Oh, a flowchart. Well, next in the flowchart actually is I for invitation, and that's to find out what they want to know. So if it's me, I'm like, just tell me. I want to know all of it and spill it. But maybe they just want to know what the diagnosis is and then you process from there, or they want to know test results, or they want to know what's going to happen from here. But what do they know and what do they want to know after you set up the environment are the next steps.
Now, I feel like this is honestly for me the hardest part of spikes, because how do you ask someone, what do you want to know? Because most people are going to say, well, I want to know everything.
Or, I agree with you.
But what is everything? Different people are going to see that different ways. Does that mean I go through every part of your labs or stuff like that? Another example being someone who you've done all this testing. A lot of times I go through and I quickly explain, these are your normal labs, but I'm not going through and explaining all the different details. Even though they say I want to know everything, usually I can hit, you know, kind of the normal tests and say most of the tests came back normal. Here's what we did on those, but you have these types of things. So just keep in mind, just because they say I want to know everything doesn't actually mean everything. And again, you don't want to give them all this huge information up, because most of the time they're not actually going to process it that way. But I don't know. Do you have any special tips on the invitation side? Because it's so hard to do this well.
Yeah, this is the trickiest part. And I actually didn't come across a lot that instructs you on and dealing with that, because it's just going to be totally individualized, except for, I think you're right, there's that you're the healthcare provider in the room. And without being paternalistic, that's your job, right? To be there. Like, the patient is there because you're the healthcare provider and you have to give them some direction or know what's going on. I think taking it in steps is probably helpful. Like you alluded to, Chip, that they say everything and you're like, well, maybe we'll start with fill in the blank lab values so that you're not overwhelming. But it sometimes what has come up in some of the reading I did was if you're dealing with a family member or you're dealing with a culture where the family doesn't want the patient to know, it would be great ahead of time before you did the test if you knew, if the patient wants to know the results or if they just want their kids to know the results, if the patient doesn't want their family to know the results. That's one thing, in at least who are you sharing it with, obviously staying within HIPAA, but it's tough and it's going to be totally situationally dependent.
It's too hard, even in a podcast like this, where we're focusing on the subject, to even say, how do you properly invite? Because like you said, there's going to be a lot of factors. I feel like invitation usually ties in with perception pretty well, because you're going to pick up on a lot of this. Because what you're trying to do a lot of times is fill in the blanks for the patient. If they knew they had a spot, okay, well, you know they have a spot. Let's go into a little more detail on that, because is that what you came in for? And especially with your patients, when you do the initial history and physical, that great H&P we all learned in school, part of that needs to be that, what made you come in today? Because if you ask them that, especially in the emergency department side of things, if you ask them, well, what made you come in today? Usually they can say, I just want to know what this is. Okay, so the emphasis is on diagnosis. Most likely that's what they mean by that phrase. So let's focus on diagnosis as the first part of the knowledge sharing, which, can we go into K now, I guess?
Great transition. That's knowledge, giving knowledge. So that's your time to share the information. This is you delivering the bad news. And like we said before, don't be ambiguous, but be aware of the patient's reaction, not only their words, but what their body language and their face is telling you too.
And this is one of those times, this is tricky, because being aware of reaction is actually something that not only you're watching body language, but literally their response. And you go through the different stages of grief, and sometimes people get really violent with this, and sometimes you're going to be able to kind of predict this ahead of time. You know, the upset parent who's pacing, who's getting very agitated with staff, maybe it's time to actually go ahead, if you have security, to call security. And I try not to let them intervene at all, but I want them there to at least keep everyone safe and just say, this is understanding. And this is usually a great time if there's going to be something like that, or if you foresee this coming. And this is good when you break bad news in general. Break bad news in a setting that's safe for them. So if you can, you know, you had the family member who's died when you've tried to help them out or whatever. We have a special room at my department that we try and sit people in whenever possible. That room is nice, clean, quiet, but also there's not much furniture in there, because the idea is that if they break something in there, we can replace that. It's no big deal. Keep in mind, some people are going to respond like that. A lot of people aren't. A lot of people will actually, again, turn submissive, cry, those types of very natural reactions. But keep in mind, all these reactions are things that can happen. You can have someone who, again, that agitated person in the hallway who just wants to know what's going on, breaks down and cries, didn't get upset, didn't throw a fight or anything like that. If you do call security, this is one tip I have, is make sure security is not visible at any point, because all that does is make things worse. And because people anticipate that something's bad is going to happen, and they'll actually even lash out more, or they'll get upset because they're around too, because they're not actually the people delivering the bad news. They're just the people who are kind of containing the situation. So just keep in mind, anytime you involve security for most things, especially when you're breaking bad news, keep them out of sight and out of mind.
Yeah, this person's just had some amount of control taken away from them and whatever their future holds, and adding more people into the mix just kind of escalates, you know. It's possible we're going to be taking even more control away from you. So I think, being aware and always being in a safe space. But people also might totally shut down. Whatever the reaction is, as long as you're safe, let it be. This is a time for you to be really patient and let the person have their reaction. And you're just present almost as a witness for them, to be there for them. But whatever they have is okay. It's valid.
And can we just say that silence is okay? Can we throw that out there right now, that silence is okay? This is a time when they're crying, they're upset. You do not have to fill the air, because sometimes if you go into the next steps too quickly, it's actually really ineffective. So it's okay to sit there, be quiet. And we didn't mention this yet, but we should mention it right now too, keeping in mind the silence and the waiting and the pause. This is something that when you have bad news, when you're going to deliver this, especially if you know this is going to be bad news for that patient, provide yourself with time. And I've done this before, where I've been in the middle of a busy shift and it's going to be that time to break that bad news. And I tell who's ever with me, and if it's for whatever reason, a solo coverage situation, or if it's somewhere where I don't have someone who can necessarily watch my patients for me for the next 10, 15 minutes or however long it's going to take, where I can just say, hey, just kind of keep an eye on things, I'm going to be busy for the next few minutes. If you at least tell the staff that I'm going to be tied up in this room, please do not disturb me unless it's a true emergency and you need something right this moment. But otherwise, please take care of things and I'll be back as quick as I can. But make sure you have the time set away. And you can do this also in the clinic setting for those who are working in the clinic or urgent care setting. Again, right now, especially at this moment, this is the most important patient in your mind. You should be focusing on this person as much as possible.
I think that comes with the setting up, that you've protected space, but you, in doing so, protect the time as well. That's a really good point. No one wants to feel rushed through the worst moment of their life, or a really terrible moment of their life.
You're having a bad day, but I've also got other people with bad days. That doesn't usually work out well for people.
No, that would be terrible, right? We're talking a lot about emotion. That's the E in spikes. It's emotions, addressing the patient's emotions with empathy. We try to say, I'm sorry, a lot. It means a lot of different things. It doesn't always mean an apology. The patients take it a lot of different ways. Sometimes it's just the right thing to say, but use caution. People talk about using caution with it. We use a training module in the program here called doc.com, doc.com. They talk there about saying, I wish instead. I wish this were different. I wish I had better news. I wish we had better treatments. Instead of, I'm sorry this is happening, it can just kind of be taken as a way, I wish, as a way to say, I'm on your side and my goals for you align with your goals. I'm on your team here. So a little time out for empathy. There is a team, Reese and Kraft Todd. Helen Reese has done a lot of work on empathy. There's a 2014 paper that outlines this really interesting mnemonic. I don't know how they made it fit into empathy, but it spells empathy. So we're Spikes. This is our second mnemonic.
Empathy. A mnemonic and a mnemonic. It's mnemonicception.
It's meta mnemonics. It's empathy spells eye contact, muscles of facial expression, posture, affect, tone, hearing, and hearing meaning you hearing the patient, really listening. We'll talk about listening in a second. And then your response. You don't make it about you, and you don't want to escalate and match. You want to show empathy, but you don't have to escalate the situation. If someone gets mad, you getting mad isn't going to help. So watch your response. All these things convey our empathy to patients. And so much more of what we convey is done visually than with the words that we're saying. How you're making someone feel comes across way more in all the subtle visual cues that you do than in any of the words that you're saying.
Some of the things to talk about with this, and I'm really curious with the I wish part. Do you still say, I'm sorry that Mr. Smith died, or how do you put that in an I wish form? Because I'm really curious how you could change the wording there.
I wish I had better news is one of the, I wish I had better news, Mr. Smith has died, instead of, I'm sorry. It's like a replacement, right? There's also the kind of cold part of this in that when patients feel cared for, they're less likely to sue you. And so speaking about that, there's the concept that I hate even kind of bringing up, but I'm sorry might seem like an admission of guilt. And it's something for the lawyers to sort out, but it was another kind of cue in that it's another way that I'm sorry can be taken as an apology or as an admission of guilt instead of, obviously in that situation, I think most people are saying, I'm expressing sadness for what you're going through. But if that's what you want to say, then you could just say that too. I'm so sad for what you're going through right now. So think about replacing I wish. The other thing that comes up about trying not to say is I understand what you're going through, or I can imagine. If you haven't been through this exact thing, then you can't understand. The other thing is, even if you have, you're not that person, so you don't know how they're perceiving it. So do avoid, don't say, I understand, or I can imagine, because you really can't, and you're just kind of inviting conflict.
And that's one that's so natural. A lot of times we don't think about it.
Right.
Is we misspeak and we don't even realize that we just misspoke when we talk to a patient. And that's a very easy one. And this is actually one of those times when body language is probably more important than the words you actually say. And so sometimes for me with breaking bad news, I actually don't say a whole lot on the emotion side. I just simply show the emotion with it.
Right. Yeah. As long as you're conveying that you care, that seems to be, it's not necessarily the words, but in the reading that if the patient knows you care, that's what makes a big difference.
One other part with that real quick too, because you mentioned the I'm sorry about lawsuits. That's a very interesting piece if we can include that in the show notes too, because I actually went through my university where we trained. We actually had the I'm sorry program for when you do create an error, because the idea was that based on some information they had at the time was that you're less likely to be sued if you said, I'm sorry that this happened, meaning an event you caused because of the, I'm not going to try and cover up, I'm not going to try and hide it, we'll make sure to do it. So I find that very interesting with that. I'm curious to read that one a little bit more.
Yeah, it's not that if you say, I'm sorry, you're more likely to get sued. If the patient feels like you don't care about them.
It goes back to the empathy and tone. Okay, that makes sense.
That's when if people just think you're being a jerk, that's when you're more likely to get sued.
There we go. Okay. So one other thing I wanted to ask about that too is, because it's not in the empathy mnemonic or specifically emotions part, what about crying? Not just the patient crying, but...
But you crying?
Yes, yes.
Right. I didn't come across any of that. I can tell you just personally, anecdotally, I've done both. Sometimes it's been upsetting and I've tried to come across as strong, or sometimes I've just let the emotions go. And not that you're losing control of yourself or you have to step out and it becomes about you. You don't want to lose control of your emotions where now it's about you. But I personally feel very comforted when I can see that the person experiences the emotions I'm experiencing. I mean, that is empathy, right? When you at least can imagine how the other person feels. I just personally don't think that there's too much wrong with that if you get teary or if you're not being stony about it. I feel comforted.
That's my thoughts with it too, is that, I mean, usually I try and deliver it well, but sometimes you do just get choked up a little bit with it, or you do end up crying. And I think that's okay, as long as, just like you said, Adrian, you don't make it about you.
If the patient ends up comforting you in their time of need, then something has gone wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have saved the best for last. Who knows?
It is. I think it is kind of the best for last. You have a great thing from your own PA training about this, but the last S is strategy and summary. And really, you're reassuring the patient that you're there for them and you're a partner in their care with them, and you're not leaving. Your plan isn't to leave. That you're going to be there and not be abandoned. And you have something to say about that, Chip, right?
Right. I have a great physician who is part of our PA program. And Dr. Moynihan's her name. I know she won't mind the name drop because she is such an awesome person. The number one thing she taught us was, I will not abandon you. It's probably the most important phrase that they'll hear out of all of it. It's not the diagnosis. It's not how you care. It literally goes back to just the basics of, if you can say, I will not abandon you, meaning so much in so many different ways. And it may simply be the fact that, especially in primary care, this is a very strong phrase to say, because a lot of people feel like they have just been abandoned. And it's for all different reasons. But when you get in this horrible situation, they feel like they've just now been shut up inside. And if you can at least tell them that, no, I really do care for you, I will not abandon you, it is very important for those people to hear that when they're getting this bad news. Sometimes for us, especially in the emergency department side, that I will not abandon you is not necessarily in a sense of, I'm going to be with you long term on this, because you may never see them again. In fact, a lot of times you probably won't ever see them again. Mm-hmm. But if you can at least say, I am here for you, whatever you need, I will try and do for you, is another way of saying, I will not abandon you, with giving that patient the idea of, this is what matters.
I think you're totally right. It's that someone doesn't feel alone. You have seen the truth of what's going on. You listen, you acknowledge what's going on with them and validate it. It just comes back to, everything comes back to communication, that everyone wants to feel understood and not judged for whatever they're going through, that their feelings are validated and they know that you're still there with them. Maybe you can't make that promise. You change practices or you're moving, but you still care and you're a partner with them and caring for them. That might seem obvious. You might think, well, obviously I'm here for you. Obviously I'm your healthcare provider and I care about what's going on. But it might not be clear to the patient. So you kind of have to go above and beyond to make sure they understand you're there with them in this and you do care what's going on. If you don't care what's going on, that's a much deeper reflection that you have to think about in your own career.
And I think that's a pretty good segue into the other part of this, is actually the actual strategy and summary in and of itself of what you're going to do next. Because maybe you are leaving that practice, or maybe you are in the ED and this is your one and only time to actually ever see this patient. Mm-hmm. It's so important that you plan ahead whenever possible, because most of the time you can wait a little bit to deliver that bad news. And I'm not talking about, it's like, well, it's right at the end of my shift, I'll push this off to the next guy or whatever. What I'm talking about is, you can usually hold off a couple of minutes to help coordinate the next steps in care. Because to me, one of the biggest parts of delivering this bad news is not just telling them the news, but also telling them what can happen next.
Right.
We talk about shared decision making all the time, where we give patients options and here are the best options. This is extremely hard to do in this kind of setting. So you want to plan as much ahead as possible. Now, let's go back to the patient with new diagnosis of cancer. I don't tend to call our oncologist or an oncologist on call somewhere if it's not where we directly have an oncologist. But this is going to be one of those times I'm going to do that. If it's brand new diagnosis in the department, I'm going to have that call with them and say, I'm sorry to wake you, but this is what I have. And I think it's very important that they get to see you as soon as possible. When can we set this up and how can we get them in contact with you? Because even though maybe for that oncologist who's making new diagnoses or following up with new diagnoses all the time, for this patient, for this scenario, we want to make sure that we have a solid follow-up plan and that we can get this person exactly where they need to go, not saying, well, here's a local list of oncologists for you to follow up. You can give a call one of them tomorrow. Try and avoid that if you can. If you can give them, this is the exact oncologist I talked to. He's very understanding in this situation. He is aware of what's going on. He wants to see you tomorrow so he can talk to you further about this, because I know you're not going to remember everything I tell you tonight. That strategy and summary right there has just basically gotten everything that you need together, so that a lot of times the patient is not going to remember, like we talked about, everything you tell them tonight. They're going to ask all the same questions again, or they may ask you later before they leave. So if you can say, this is the person who I have for you to follow up with, this is the next step. Maybe it's that kid with that fracture that's going on. I've talked to the orthopedic surgeon. They're going to be able to see you, and we're going to get this all squared away. This is the type of stuff that this is worth getting that strategy and that plan set up for follow-up. This is so important to get those next steps going, so that way the patient's not left and felt like they've, again, been abandoned because they don't know what to do next.
I'm big on analogies and kind of imagery. And as you're talking about that, I'm imagining you're crossing this really wide, rushing river. And maybe you're on one side and the oncologist is on the other side, and the patient has to cross that river. And it might just be the next day, but it might be what they're crossing is their entire disease process. I'm imagining like rocks or stepping stones. And you're like, we're just going to the next stepping. For right now, the next stepping stone is this. And I'm right here shouting encouragement from the other side, or maybe I'm jumping through it with you. But first we go from here to this stepping stone, and from this stepping stone to the next. And at some point, maybe you see them all ahead of you. But for right now, our next move is this. And how do you feel about that?
I really like your analogy there. That's perfect.
Thanks. Right. Next steps. That's how we're summarizing that. You might not get to that right away. You might not get through all these spike steps either in the whole time, but it's kind of a goal, or just your own path of stepping stones when you know you have to do this.
And especially especially in one sit down, right? Because you may have that where the emotion is so strong, they may not want to talk anymore. They may just completely shut down. Family even asks you, like, could you just give us a few minutes? That's fine. I feel like that's okay to do. It's okay to stop at certain points in this, just be able to let things calm down a little bit, let them gather themselves back up again. And maybe then you go back in the room and you talk a little more about, for example, the strategy.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah. Don't just get to giving the knowledge and then leaving. You don't get to drop a bomb and walk away.
Awesome. So I think we're on to the next part. We have accomplished spikes, the big part of our conversation, but there's still a little more to this, right?
Yeah. There's still a little bit more that doesn't get touched on just with spikes alone. We talked about listening. Don't talk about yourself. Even if you think you have the best story that's going to help someone feel better, this is not the place. There's a great book that's not an official medical textbook, but I think maybe it should be, that I really love. I think everyone should read it, especially if you're in medicine. It's called There Is No Good Card for This: What to Say and Do When Life is Scary, Awful, and Unfair to the People You Love. And it's by Kelsey Crow, who's a PhD, and Emily McDowell. And they kind of just go through different scenarios in life and help guide you through as the support person for what to say and do, what's helpful, what's not helpful. And they actually did a lot of great research with people who've gone through trauma to say what was helpful. When people thought they were being helpful, what were you actually sick of? You didn't want one more lasagna dropped off. Kinds of things that are actually practical so you don't freeze. And I think it really just applies to being a healthcare provider too, because they give a lot of great examples of literally words to say and words not to say.
That's great. I'll have to look into that book some more. We'll try and include that in the show notes as well. We're going to have a lot of show notes for this episode.
Well, you asked an EBM person to come on, so.
And you came with references. I love it.
Yeah, well, so. You're welcome. In summary, I think it just comes down to listen, acknowledge, validate, and show you care. Not just in delivering bad news, but literally in every conversation that you have with someone. If you can do those things, I think your life's going to go a lot smoother.
There's almost a touch of hippie there, Adrian. No,
more than a touch, I think.
Honestly, one of the best phrases I ever heard, and I literally just told a student the other day this, is they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
That sums it.
I think that just sums it up right there. So I would like to just include a couple of quick things just because we did have a kind of longer podcast. So we talked a lot about all different things, how you introduce this, some anecdotes that we've experienced. And like I said, we'll have follow-up on this on kind of some really tough specific scenarios just because I feel like it's a good idea to talk about. This is a lot of a primer in some ways, but this is something that you can literally use in your next shift, and probably most of us will use, whether we realize it or not. Again, not everyone is every time someone who's dying or is going to die, but this is about that event where just you give some news that they just really didn't want to hear, they didn't know was going to come. And so longest part is it's all about the delivery, the communication, just like you said, and you really have to show truly empathy. This is not the time when you just put on that smile on your face and move on and grit your teeth. This is the time when it really, truly, absolutely matters. Mm-hmm. And the biggest part we talked about that was with the Spikes protocol. And so as a quick summary of the Spikes protocol, Adrian?
It's setting up. What's the environment like? Perception. What does the patient know? Invitation. What do they want to know? Knowledge. Share the information clearly. Don't be ambiguous. Emotions. Address the patient's emotions and with empathy. And then strategy and summary. That's the last S.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Adrian, any other thoughts on this? I mean, we've talked about this a lot, but there's always more information. I didn't know if you have anything specifically you wanted to say.
No, I think that your exit actually, if you don't mind if I deliver it this time, really kind of sums up this podcast perfectly.
Go ahead.
Well, until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.